The subject of consciousness beyond life, the science of the near-death experience, coming up in just a moment. I wanted to reflect back on something that was said last hour as we were talking a little bit about some of that discussion that the guy said about what the police officer told him about retaliation for 9/11. I keep trying to find anything out about that, and I can't. But I'm going to look into that, because if there's any truth to that, then that can't be this well-kept secret that a police officer would tell a motorist like that at random about. So I'm looking into it, but it does remind me that coming up on the 21st of August, we'll try something we haven't done before on Coast to Coast. It's a Saturday night, and I will be hosting a debate between two primary individuals and then one or two other people that they'll be able to pull in off the bench to help make their case. Richard Gage is an architect of many decades of experience, who is a founder of a group that seeks what he calls the truth of 9/11. He has extensive experience in fireproofed steel frame structures, which he says is very informative when it comes to the way in which the World Trade Center towers came down. On the other side of the story is Dave Thomas, a mathematician and a physicist, and he too will have some perspectives on what some people call just the official story of 9/11. And I'm looking forward to this conversation. It'll be happening on August 21st. Let everybody you know who's interested in it, as there'll be many opportunities to get in on the phones on that night. But circle that. You don't want to miss Coast to Coast. You don't want to miss it at any time. You don't want to miss tonight's show. You'll be talking about this for weeks, maybe years. I promise you. This book is just amazing. It's a collection of scientifically focused chapters on aspects of the near-death experience through the lens of Pim Van Lommel. He's a doctor, a very well-respected cardiologist, a large hospital, plus many publications to his credit. And he has been studying the near-death experience scientifically for many years. You might remember we had Peter Fenech on the show within the last year, and he had been doing studies from his own perspective about near-death experiences in England. Well, his research is compared to consciousness beyond life, which is so comprehensive here, it makes Peter Fenech's work, while terrific, seem like a pamphlet that somebody left under your windshield wiper in a parking lot. This is a huge, thick, but still very readable book, Consciousness Beyond Life, and it's made thicker by the number of pages that I've had to dog ear while reading it, because they're just so amazing. Both these stories and the statistics and the perspective on life after death from the as told by people who have survived near-death experiences, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Pim Van Lommel, am I pronouncing all of those words correctly? Am I off to a good start?
Yes.
Okay. And Dr. Lommel, or is it Dr. Van Lommel?
It's Dr. Van Lommel. Yeah.
Okay. I'll endeavor to get that right every time.
Yeah.
Just love what you did here. I mean, you have done something with this book, Consciousness Beyond Life. You may have not proved the case beyond a shadow of a doubt for those that are looking for doubt, but you make as comprehensive an argument based on your research for the eternity of the soul, or at least the eternity of the consciousness, as I think could possibly be done.
Yes, I think doing the empirical studies on patients with cardiac arrest, you have to come to the conclusion that it is highly possible that there's a continuity of consciousness beyond life.
Well, and I think that it's important to talk about some of the ways and some of the strengths of the research, and then maybe some of the areas in this research where it is a little more, we might say, wobbly. But yeah. In the case of the cardiac arrest patient, this is being sort of the core of the work you have done. Talk about the characteristics of somebody having experienced a cardiac arrest, which makes this person such a perfect study for a life after death argument.
Yeah, well, according to our current medical concepts, it's not possible to experience consciousness during cardiac arrest when circulation and breathing have ceased. So in 1969, as a rotating intern, it was the first years of coronary care units. We had a resuscitation of a man, and we were, as a resuscitation team, we were very happy that we succeeded to get him back. But the patient was very, very disappointed being back. So that was the question: how is it possible that during a period of apparent unconsciousness, during a life-threatening crisis like cardiac arrest, it is possible to patients have memories of this period? And so only in 86, I read a book about near-death experiences by George Ritchie. And I started to interview patients in my outpatient clinic who had survived a cardiac arrest, if they could remember something of the period of consciousness. And to my big surprise, out of 50 patients I asked in 2 years, 12 patients told me the near-death experience.
Well, that's 50 patients in 2 years, 12 of whom had strong memories of having experienced something.
Exactly.
And then which even leaves open, I was going to say, even leaves open the possibility that maybe others had some experience, they just didn't remember having had one.
Well, we didn't know, because the first thing is that it was just, because it was scientifically impossible to have this kind of experience. And this was, for me, the kind of pilot study. And then in 88, we started a prospective study in 10 Dutch hospitals, and we included in 4 years about 344 patients, the consecutive patients who survived cardiac arrest, just to study how it is possible, if we can have an explanation, why patients can experience enhanced consciousness during cardiac arrest, because we didn't know yet. All studies done until that time had been retrospective, which means that you ask patients or people to write you if you had an experience in the past. And so you didn't know exactly what happened to them in the hospitals. And you have a high selective of patients. You don't know which patient will write a letter or call you, or which patient won't. So the prospective study we did in hospitals was the only scientific method to study these kind of experiences.
I want to amplify that by just because I read this particular section and I think it's an interesting thing to separate out. A retrospective study, meaning that somebody would run like an ad in the newspaper and say, hey, has anybody had this experience? And then you get kind of a, you know, we would say catch-as-catch-can kind of response, as opposed to a prospective study, which set out a criteria for the people that you were going to, you know, you were going to prospect for them. You knew where they would be, the likely place for them to be, and you were going to go and find them, and you were going to ask them these questions just after they had their cardiac arrest. So you weren't depending on them to have some, you know, recall from years later. They were going to be able to tell you immediately after their experience. Doctors were going to open their ears to this possibility right away.
Exactly. To be honest, most nurses did it better than doctors.
Most nurses did it better than doctors. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me, Dr. Van Lommel, especially the way I you know, as I said, I dog-eared a million pages in here. I kept sharing this one particular story that I want to read here in just a moment about one of the places you went to And you were speaking, and I'll share this in just a minute because I think it's so interesting. But you're the most important thing is that you started doing this prospective study, and for 25 years you were gathering data before you wrote this book. That makes this book the most comprehensive book on the subject so far in the history of mankind.
That's very kind of you.
It's true. And we've had, I love Dr. Fenwick's work in England. I thought he was great. I was so glad to see him referenced in your book, but he didn't have nearly the amount of data on people who had just returned from from having been brain dead, having had no brain activity, having had no oxygen, having been technically dead and then brought back. He doesn't have the amount of data that you have.
You're right. Because we had only large prospective study where we could do also statistics, and his study was too small to do it.
But that's the key thing, is it too, is that doctors have to be open to it. And you were amongst the first, Dr. Fenwick being another good example from England.
I know.
But there's a small group of you, right? I mean, there's not many that have said, I think this is happening. Why are doctors so, especially cardiologists, why are they unfriendly to the subject?
Well, because we can't believe it. In our study, it's just the materialistic science. We learn from as medical students and also as doctors that consciousness is just a product of the function of the brain. So it's impossible to experience consciousness, enhanced consciousness during cardiac arrest. And I had some physicians who had a near-death experience, and they told me, what happened to me now? I've always said this is impossible, and now it's happened to me. So they cannot be open because they cannot believe it's possible.
Well, to explain that, I'm going to this one experience. I hope you don't mind me reading.
No. I know what you're going to read.
Yeah, it's such a perfect story.
Yeah.
So you were you were doing a presentation in the United States. I believe you were in Atlanta. Does that sound right? Am I getting the location right?
Not in that location, but it doesn't matter.
Okay. Well, research had shown that most patients remain silent about their near-death experience because nobody believes them when they first try to talk about this. This was confirmed during an NDE conference at an American University hospital in 1994, attended by some 300 people. After a few presentations on near-death experiences and somebody's personal story, a man got up and said, I've worked as a cardiologist for 25 years now, and I've never come across such absurd stories in my practice. I think this is all complete nonsense, and I don't believe a word of it. Whereupon another man stood up and said, I'm one of your patients. A couple of years ago, I survived a cardiac arrest and had a near-death experience, and you would be the last person I would ever tell. I mean, it's true. If you don't think the person is going to be receptive to it, you wouldn't embarrass yourself by saying something that they're going to think you're crazy for saying.
And they're already embarrassed themselves because they can. It's such an impressive experience that they cannot accept it themselves. It's very hard to accept when you try to share it with others. Just they don't believe you. So that's a real problem.
And that's one of the reasons why nurses are probably better for gathering this type of information, a little less judgmental, a little more patient friendly, and not treating the patient as just a science sample, you know, not just as a whole person. So as people were coming out of cardiac arrest, what would be the questions you would ask in your research, and how soon after the experience would they be asked these questions?
We just had one question, and the question was, do you have memories of the period of unconsciousness? That was the only question. It was an open question. And we asked them this question in the first days after the cardiac arrest when they were feeling well again. So more than 80% of the patients had been asked this question within 2-3 days after the cardiac arrest. But sometimes patients are in coma for weeks, so you had to be later to ask these questions. But always within several days.
And as an open question, they could simply say no.
Exactly.
Or they could say, why, yes, I have. Yeah. But what's interesting about that being an open question was the number of people who had a similar experience. Without any prompting, they tell very much the same story in details that are specific to their particular case.
Yeah. Well, the elements people can tell about, they are universal elements that have been told in the whole human history, in all times, in all religions or cultures. But they always use their own words. A child will use different words as an adult, and somebody who's an atheist will use different words as a Christian or a Buddhist or a Hindu. So you try to find words for an experience, but which is really ineffable. There are no words for it.
Right. Yeah. The vocabulary might change depending on the experience,
exactly.
but the experience didn't change. It's just what would you say would be the defining characteristics of the near-death experience in your 25 years of research?
Well, there are about 12 elements which not all people will tell you, because some have only 3 or 4 elements experience, and others have many more elements experience. And the more elements people can remember, the deeper the near-death experience is called. But the first thing is that the pain is gone. That the pain of the traffic accident, the pain of your cardiac arrest from your myocardial infarction. You don't feel your body anymore, and you have not. You're very at ease. And you're feeling very happy, and you ask yourself, "Well, is this death? I'm dead now." And then you can have sometimes hear some noise, but mostly you have the possibility to have perception out and above your body, and you have a theoretical perception of things that are happening during resuscitation or for the traffic accident or for the surgery. And this is a very important aspect of the near-death experience, because it proves that the near-death experience happens in the period of unconsciousness and not the first or last seconds. And then they can become in a dark space, which can be very frightening for some of them. And in this dark space, there's a small light where they're attracted to it, and they call it mostly a tunnel. And through this tunnel, they come in a light, which is unconditional love and compassion.
And that's how they describe it.
That's how they describe it.
It's unconditional love. So they feel this warm light that
yeah,
lets
incredible.
Them know.
It's so bright light, but it doesn't is problem for your eyes, because you don't see with your eyes.
Right.
And then they come in another dimension, in not worldly dimension, where they beautiful landscape, beautiful music, and sometimes also meeting deceased relatives, where they can have communication with.
And then there's the border. So let's hang on that thought, that boundary experience where these patients that are experiencing a near-death memory, they have a distinct recall on a boundary they could not cross. They just knew instinctively they were drawn toward the light, but they knew if they crossed this one area, they could never come back. And so we're going to pick this up in just a second. Dr. Pim van Lommel, world-renowned cardiologist, medical expert, and author of Consciousness Beyond Life, The Science of the Near-Death Experience, page for page, just like jaw-dropping in so many cases. And we'll give you an example of that. The story of Pamela Reynolds from the United States. It defines the near-death experience. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Dr. Pim van Lommel, he is an expert on cardiology as well as the conductor of this 25-year study into near-death experiences. And we were just talking about the boundaries. We'll get back to that coming up. I want to also highlight something else on the way this Saturday night on Coast to Coast. We'll be talking about vaccination A. There are many people who are tracking this story. I think we can safely say that on Coast to Coast, we've been following this a lot more than others have over the years and giving it the kind of attention that it deserves. Vaccination A, it may be the explanation for some of our more complicating phenomenon, medical phenomenon lately. And if you've been following, you know, some of these ongoing investigations into problems with the health of returning veterans, then you're going to want to be listening for Vaccination A coming up this Saturday night on Coast to Coast. But back to the story of Pamela Reynolds, her near-death experience, and what it says about the boundary. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. We were talking with Dr. Pim Van Lommel about the characteristics of the typical near-death experience, and that while not everybody has exactly the same experience, most people have most of these aspects of what they went through in their while they or their body had ceased to function, they were still on this similar journey. First, they would be recognizing that they were leaving their body because they were no longer in pain. As Dr. Van Lommel was saying, the pain of the heart attack was just going away, and they were leaving their body. They were often seeing themselves in the room. They were looking down on themselves. They often go to a kind of light, which gives them this feeling of total well-being. And although they are seeing something, they don't have eyes to see it, but in their mind's eye, as they go toward this light, it's a warm but extremely bright light, yet one that doesn't make them wince or feel like they're looking into the sun. It's not harsh. It's unique in that way. And the fact that people keep using the same descriptions about that light in and of itself is so fascinating. But then they know that as they approach that light, they feel like all is well, and that they feel loved, and they know that they're cared for. But as they go closer to that light, they may hear and or see comforting images such as relatives. Now, before I go any further, before we go to the boundary, which I think is one of the most interesting aspects of this research, was there any consistency to the relatives that the people would see after 25 years of research into cardiac arrest patients? Was there anything that was typical about the relatives that they would see on the other side?
Well, the relatives had died. And some that they even didn't know that the relatives were dead, or small children met grandmother or grandfather, they didn't even know that they had existed. And the most impressive story I heard, that a man who had a cardiac arrest had a very extensive experience, and he saw, apart from his deceased grandmother, a man who had looked at him lovingly, but whom he did not know. And more than 10 years later, at his mother's deathbed, she confessed to him that he had been born out of an extramarital relationship, his father being a Jewish man who had been deported and killed during the Second World War. And his mother showed him his picture. And the unknown man he had seen before, more than 10 years before, during his, and he turned out to be his biological father.
Mm.
So and they're very, very impressive stories.
Yeah, and there was another story like that where somebody had died, and they had the name of a child that they did not know, and they mentioned it to their mother, and their mother said, "There's something I've been meaning to tell you."
Exactly. A girl who was near drowning. She was 5 years old, and she became conscious and said, but this was not a problem. My brother was with me. And she had a brother, but he died before she was born. And her parents had thought, well, we wait until she's older before we tell her. But she has met her brother during her near-death experience.
Now, again, what's so unique about what Dr. Van Lommel has done is, as a scientist, he has researched this with people who have just come back from a cardiac arrest, which means that all brain activity has stopped. In many cases, blood flow has stopped, oxygen has stopped. And yet there seemed to be this almost infinite amount of time in their experience, right? There was no sense, as these people were having their near-death experience, that the clock was ticking. They were unaware of, you know, I've been gone for 20 seconds or 30 seconds. It just felt like this sort of a flowing sense of time.
Well, it's very special for this experience of enhanced consciousness. It's experiencing a dimension without our conventional concept of time and space. Everything right. happens at the same time. When you have a life review, that means that you see and feel again everything, what you have done and said, but also each thought you ever had is kept, and you feel the influence on yourself and on others from your whole past life. And when people come back, they can talk for days to weeks about what happened to them in this life review. Well, the cardiac arrest only took 2 or 3 minutes.
Right.
So there's no time.
Yeah, there's no time. And that's consistent with so many of these patients. So yeah. is there a consistency to the demeanor of the relatives on the other side? I mean, is there a way that the relatives almost always talk to the patient?
Well, they don't talk, they communicate. And what people tell me is that it's kind of a thought transfer. You know what they say, but the people tell me, well, when you talk, you can say that you talk about your thoughts, and the people communicate with their thoughts. So it's also when you have an out-of-body experience and you hear what is said, even deaf people who can't hear anymore know what is said during an out-of-body experience because they know the thoughts of the people.
Well, and this out-of-body experience, for example, you're talking about where deaf people were able yes. to hear things that were going on in the operating room or going on with the doctors around them who were having conversations while they are lying there on the floor or on the gurney dead. They can hear again for that period of time.
And they also can see again. So blind people, blind from birth, can perceive what is happening.
Interesting.
And people who have very strong glasses, let's say minus 11, they can't see anything without their glasses. They can have a clear perception of everything that's happening around. I know a story of a woman who saw she had problems with her childbirth, and she was resuscitated, and she was seeing everything. And then at once she saw her glasses lying there near her bed when she was looking from above. And she realized that she could see everything very clear. And normally it was impossible to see anything without her glasses.
Is that the story of, and I will return to the yeah. boundary thing in just a second, but is that the story of the woman who comes back from this tragic pregnancy where the child dies and yet she feels good? She comes yeah. back and has this almost sort of a smile on her face.
That's another story, but it's also from childbirth. The childbirth complication with childbirth is also a common cause for near-death experiences.
Yeah, because I thought there's a lot. There's the way that people treat people coming back from a near-death experience
yes.
when they start to talk about it, and right away there sometimes is the need on the person who's hearing the story to somehow normalize it or dismiss it by saying, well, you didn't have any oxygen, or you know, they try to come up with a reason, even though the other person is saying no, I just had the most incredible experience.
Excellent.
That other people try to put it into a box.
Yeah, well, the problem is because it doesn't fit in our medical concepts. It's impossible to have memories from a period of cardiac arrest. So people don't believe you. And what I said before, people can't believe in themselves what happened to them. So you're very reluctant to share it with others. It's very emotional. It's the most impressive experience you ever had in your whole life. And then people don't believe you. So you, most people get silent about it as well.
I had asked you about the demeanor of the relatives that were on the other side, so typically for the near-death experiencer. I thought the one thing that I gleaned from reading the book, Consciousness Beyond Life, is that the relatives were there to say, hi, we love you, but you got to go back.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not your time yet. You have still a task to fulfill.
Yeah, and they don't say what that is, which would be nice.
No.
Wouldn't that be nice? They say
they have to come back. Yes,
you have to come back to win the lottery. You need to go back to win the lottery. But these relatives are there to act as guides, but also to act as I don't know, almost like security. They're there to keep that person from crossing over the border, this boundary, which they almost intuitively understand. So talk about the boundary experience.
Yes. Well, people come at a moment in their experience, they see a mountain or a cloud or a wall, and they know instinctively that if I pass this wall, this boundary, I will never get back. And they are eager to go on. But the other way, they know that they have still, they hear that they still have a task to fulfill. They have to look after their small children, they have to look after their parents or whatever. So it's an inner knowing that when you shoot across this border, this boundary, you will never be able to get back.
And this is central to the experience of Pamela Reynolds.
Yes.
So I want to read about her from your book, and then I want you to comment a little bit before we get to her testimony, because her medical circumstances are perfect for your argument. She was a woman who was diagnosed with an aneurysm. She's an American woman, 35-year-old, busy working mother who had carved out a name for herself as a singer-songwriter. In 1991, she became seriously ill. She experienced extreme dizziness, loss of speech, and difficulty in moving her body. Her physician recommended a CAT scan, which revealed a giant aneurysm in one of her cerebral arteries close to the brain stem. An aneurysm is a kind of balloon-like bulge at a weakened spot in a blood vessel, not unlike a bubble on the inside of a bicycle tire. If this aneurysm burst, and the risk of this happening was considerable, a cerebral hemorrhage would be immediately fatal. She was referred to a neurologist who told her that her chances of survival were minimal, but there was one last hope for Pamela. She contacted the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, more than 2,000 miles from her hometown. And this is where this guy, Dr. Robert Spetzler, just said that he would operate on her. Talk about, Dr. Van Lommel, talk about what this surgery that he was willing to do, as long as she signed away her life. She had to sign all sorts of forms to say, whatever happens, it's not my fault. But talk about the kinds of, what they would have had to have done to her body to prepare her to repair that aneurysm.
What they do when the body is cold, has a low temperature, the need for oxygen for the brain is very, very low. That's what they do. They lower the body temperature, and then you get a cardiac arrest. So those patients also get into the heart-lung machine. And then at last, they also get all the blood out of the brain by turning the operation table up. So the body's
turned. It's like standing up, practically.
Exactly. And then come back. So the brain has no blood. The brain is hypothermic. And then the surgeon has about 30 minutes to do the operation without any blood, because you can't have any blood up there. So the surgeon did the operation with a cardiac arrest, with a heart-lung machine, with no blood in the brain. And the brain function was none, because the EEG was flat, and also the brain stem, you can do some clicking devices in the ears to see if the brain stem doesn't function. Her brain stem didn't function as well. So she was totally flat-lined, no functioning brain stem. And at this moment, she had a very extensive near-death experience.
Well, the body is down to 50 degrees, which
exactly.
Be like falling into an icy river.
That's
right. And she's standing up, and there's three different tests. If I read this right, three different tests that they use to determine that she has no brain activity at all. Can you explain the three different tests?
Well, that's the EEG. That is the registration of the electrical activity of the cortex from the brain. It's the clicking devices in the ear for the brain stem. And you can have also control of the pupils of the eyes so that don't react anymore. So, and there's a cardiac arrest as well.
Yeah. So she's.
There's nothing, no functioning at all. The total brain isn't functioning.
The induced cardiac arrest, but the clicking in the ears part, this is key because there'd be some people who would say that she can still hear, that there's a, that even, you know, even though it's low brain activity, you know, somehow through the brain stem, she can still hear. But the clicking in the ears, explain that so people know what you're talking about, that you can, they're clicking the ears, but the brain is showing no recognition of that at all.
Yeah, well, but the clicking device in the ear is to stimulate the brain stem. And when there is no response of the brain stem, it means that the brain stem isn't functioning anymore. And it's a loud noise. So when you have those clicking devices in your ear, which goes on each 2-3 seconds, it's impossible to hear any conversation outside.
Wow.
If your brain is functioning.
Even if you were fully functioning, it would be like having on headphones blasting
exactly.
heavy metal music or something.
Exactly.
You couldn't hear it. Okay.
Exactly.
So that's where I'm going to suspend this for the moment, and I want to come back and I want to read what she said.
Yes.
Because Dr. Spetzler, he's convinced that he had to be convinced that her brain was dead in order for him to be completely bloodless in order for him to fix the aneurysm. If her brain wasn't bloodless, she would have died.
Exactly. And he had, because of the hypothermia of her body and her brain, he had 30 minutes to do this operation.
So she is, even though she's hooked up to a heart-lung machine, she is effectively dead. Her brain has no function. So right there, that would qualify as the definition of death already, correct?
Well, yes, not well, it's not functioning. But let's say death is there is an irreversible damage of the brain. And here it's still reversible because
right.
of the hypothermia.
Oh, I get that. But I'm just saying that if a regular patient had zero brain activity and
then
zero brainstem activity, you would say effectively
dead.
This patient is dead.
You're totally right.
Okay, so there she is, and that's just where we'll leave Pamela for the moment, and then I'll read to you what she accounts of the experience, because it brings us right back to the relatives and the boundary and sort of the classic near-death experience. She's standing upright. The top of her head has been removed. That aneurysm at the base of her skull and her brainstem has been exposed. And they're doing the work, and the clicking in the ears goes on. Even though there is zero brain activity, they're still blocking out any possible sound. And that's really key to understand what she hears and what she experiences as she floats in the room above her own body being operated on. And we'll tell you all about that coming up. Plus, we've talked about the heavenly, quote-unquote, experiences. What about the hell-like ones on the way to Coast to Coast? This is Ian Punnett.